Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. My name is Rob Cope and I am here with Dan Farrant. How are you doing, Dan?
Doing well. How about you, Rob?
Very good. Today's episode is with Sam Leake.
Oh, lovely. I haven't seen Sam in ages.
Yeah. Now, Sam is such a big deal that he actually has a Wikipedia page.
Is that right?
That's pretty hard to do. Like, if you made one about me now and was like...
It wouldn't have anything on it.
Well, no, exactly. And then they'd delete it.
Yeah,
absolutely tragic.
Oh, he does, doesn't he? Oh, that's a good photo.
It's
well.
A lovely photo. So Sam Leake is a London-based jazz pianist. I'm not going to read the page word for word because that would be
silly. A waste of everyone's time.
Yes, that's the word. It's a waste of everyone's time.
Very much like this podcast.
Yes, that too. Although, if you skip ahead to the interview with Sam, that will be amazing.
Well, that wouldn't be a waste of time.
He's scarily intelligent. It's hard to, it's hard to even maintain my dignity throughout the show because he asks a lot of incredibly intelligent questions, being an incredibly intelligent gentleman. Mm. Mm-hmm.
So, hearing it.
Yes, I'm going to play one of his tracks right now, Dan. Sam Leake, welcome to the Jazz Podcast.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. It's episode 86, so we've done somehow... The fact that it's 86 is not to tarnish your reputation at all. Because if we do all the great people in week one, then we're going to be in a lot of trouble. So... I'm going to start putting that message out there more and
more. No, I've got it. I'm 86th on the list of jazz musicians in London. That's fine.
But on the other hand, you join us at a time when the interest in the show is booming at an all-time high. Mm.
It's amazing you've done that many. That's great.
Yeah, it's actually 2 years ago today that we released the first trailer saying that we were going to start a jazz podcast.
And I guess it's just gone from strength to strength, right?
Well, it has, because the longest gap between shows we've had in the history of the run is about 20 days. My theory with podcasts, exactly, if you just keep ploughing away and refusing to go away, and eventually people will give up and listen to it.
It's a good theory. I like it.
Yeah, it's working.
What was it that made you want to do it in the first place?
That's such a good question. I really love podcasts. I love how it's like the Netflix of TV. You know, you just listen to something that you're really interested in a really, really niche subject that's not necessarily broadcast on radio because of how niche you end up. Like, all the stuff I'm into seems to be in podcast form, not on the radio. And Dan suggested it, and it was like all the light bulbs in my brain came on at once that I couldn't believe I hadn't already thought of it. I just really love, like, the fascination of what we're about to go through. Why on earth would you choose to practice the piano for this many hours to become as good as you are? You know, it's such a weird thing to do. And every story is completely different, which is brilliant. You know,
that's great.
Again, like 86 shows, but there's, you could never do it, be like, oh, this is the best way. This is the tried and trusted. 50% of the guests did this and it worked for them. You know, it's hard to become a professional musician because there's definitely not a guaranteed path.
But for definite.
That makes all the shows really interesting.
I think it's nice being able to sort of listen to these things as you're out and about as well, isn't it? I've been doing the same thing a lot with audiobooks. As much as I like reading, it's, you know, you can go to the gym or go on a walk or any of these things and just be taking in information as you go, which is great.
Yeah, that's a great example. What kind of audiobooks?
I really like, so do you know that very short introduction series?
No, I don't know that.
That Oxford Press put out. So they're just guides to kind of pretty much any topic you could possibly want to find out about, written in the really short form way by experts. And most of them have been turned into audiobooks as well now. So you can around and hear an expert, not usually read by the person, but nonetheless, hear an expert tell you all about some area that you didn't previously know about, just as you're getting on with your daily business. I think they're great.
That's really cool. That's a great idea. I'm going to search those. I could expand my horizons significantly.
Yeah, that's why I'm doing it.
So tell us, Sam, tell us who you are for the listeners that don't already know.
I'm a jazz pianist from London. I have a band called Aquarium, although I haven't done much with them recently. I have a trio with Will Glazer and Simon Reed that I'm playing with relatively regularly. Piano duets with Dan Tapfer and Richard Fairhurst.
So Dan Tapfer's the guy who we just listened to Adrift at the start of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. So tell us, let's talk about that track or that that duo. Who is Dan?
Okay, so Dan Tapfer is a New York based piano player from France originally. He's best known for his duets with Lee Konitz. So they play all around the world all the time. Obviously, Lee Konitz is a legend of the jazz world.
Me and my wife met him a few years ago.
Oh, really? How was it?
It was really ridiculous. We were like in New York in a church doing some like this a course called the New York Jazz School or something, I think. And Lee just like wandered in and wanted to check it out, and the guys who run the course were like, oh yeah, he just lives around the corner, you know, he's just always up for a play. And I was like,
Lee, this is in the room.
I know. And then we walked past him on the street and I didn't realize, and my wife was going, hey, that's Lee again. I wanted to run up to him and be like, you're Lee Konitz, do you have any idea?
Yeah, I know that feeling. I think a worse thing happened to, do you know Alex Marriott?
Yes, saxophone player.
Yeah. So when he was up in Birmingham, I think it was like the worst possible moment it could have happened as well. So I think he was involved in some kind of relatively amateur workshop thing. And he was sort of by far and away the best person there. I was sort of wondering why he'd showed up. And next thing he knew, in the middle of this kind of not particularly fun musical experience, Lee Konitz walked into the room. And I think it just, that's one of his big heroes. It couldn't have been a worse moment.
That's brilliant. Like, you're like, no, Lee, cover your ears.
Go away. I had a similar thing with Richard Herring once. He's one of my favourite comedians, but I don't reckon he knows too much about jazz, or at least I hope not. So I think I was probably fine.
Interesting. Do you remember the North London Tavern.
Who can forget it?
Exactly. Well, David Mitchell used to come in. I don't know if you ever saw him there.
I did. I nearly ran him over once.
Really?
I was driving to a gig at the North London Tavern. I didn't really nearly run him over. But he walked out in front of the car. And like a sadist, my first thought whenever that happens is, oh, I could run him over if I wanted to.
Yeah, that's always what I think. Like, I can't believe you're trusting me to not run him over.
I had the same thing with Boris Johnson once, but maybe I should have done in retrospect.
Wow, that's really cool. We could make a Man in the High Castle style alternative history of what would have happened if you'd have knocked Boris Johnson down.
Yeah, I think the world could be a much better place.
That's really interesting. Imagine if somehow the Brexit vote went the other way as a result.
Although I'd be in prison, of course. I don't know. So.
That's it, isn't it? Would you go to prison for killing Boris Johnson in exchange for staying in the EU? Let's say you go away for 4 years for manslaughter.
Yeah.
Would you do it?
Well, with the power of retrospect and the fact it's, you know, there's no way of it being proved otherwise, of course I've done it. No question. You know, I'd defer.
I think the really
valiantly saved the UK, you know.
That would be brilliant. But the hard thing about that is that
I can't promise that's true. Yeah.
No one would have known what a hero you would be. That's the, you know, disappointing element. It's like,
that's the proper romantic hero, isn't it? You know, you're It's like that Dylan Moran thing. He describes all disgruntled adults as you know, these quiet people walking around safe in the knowledge inside that no one will ever understand that they're really a guitar hero, a knight or something.
Brilliant. So
delivered better by him.
No, I enjoyed that a lot. Okay, so let's go back in time. We'll come back to the tracks.
Oh, yeah.
When did you, like, what age were you when you started playing the piano?
I started playing the piano really young. I can't remember. Probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 or something like that. I was really annoyed in retrospect. I'm doing this PhD on absolute pitch acquisition. And
that sounds awesome.
Yeah, that's not what I'm annoyed about. I'm happy about that. But it's interesting. Apparently, a lot of people who do Suzuki training when they're really young children just end up developing pretty happening absolute pitch. It depends on the way in which it's taught. But if it's taught kind of by ear rather than you can teach Suzuki in a way where people can watch you demonstrating as well, that's another valid way of doing it. And I think less people would develop absolute pitch that way. But it seems like a pretty good way of doing it. And I had a teacher who wanted to do Suzuki lessons with me, and my mum decided that was some hippie shit and wasn't up for it, and got me a standard teacher who went through the grades. And in retrospect, it's very frustrating. But anyway.
Oh, man. Yeah, now that you're doing this PhD, you're like come full circle on what you could have done.
The good news is I think it's to the extent that the layman understands it, I think it is a learnable skill.
Can you explain a little more? Like, just tell us what Suzuki is.
That's not what I meant as such. So I don't know too much about the Suzuki method, but...
But it's largely taught by ear rather than by sight.
In theory, it can be taught by sight, but it's not taught from music.
Okay.
So you can watch a teacher demonstrating it. And I think there's a difference between the kind of outcomes from students that have been taught one way and the other.
Right.
But essentially, you learn a set of tunes by ear, I think in a variety of keys. And the idea is because you're spending so much time working on these same tunes and you're doing it in this by ear kind of way, you kind of end up learning a bit more about the absolute pitch content than you would do if you did the kind of standard UK thing of, you know, ploughing your way through some beginner's piano book and then going through grade one and neglecting the oral side of it.
Right, okay.
Pretty much entirely, you know. I think there are big differences in the ways that people are taught music in different cultures that are reflected in things like the East Asian advantage for absolute pitch. The fact that you have things like the Yamaha organ method, which involve students being taught pretty much entirely by ear from the offset, and then moving on to instruments after that point, you know, the difference between that and what we have over here is just ridiculous, you know?
Cool. I've never really thought about it, which makes this incredibly interesting, of course.
What's your relationship with air trading? How are your...
Well, that's a good question. When I was at school, I had a guy, a music teacher called Peter Hatfield, who I was at a music school, so I was sort of fortunate to have a lot of varied musical experiences.
Which school?
At Cheetham's.
Oh, amazing. Great.
It was really great. I really enjoyed it. And this guy, he was a bit, you know, he's a bit like finding Obi-Wan Kenobi. similar kind of appearance to Alec Guinness. Anyway.
Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, precisely. He'd be really into, like, he would drill us on intervals just incredibly intensely every day for like 5 years of my life between maybe 10 and 14, you know? And to be honest, that now is how I live my life and survive all the experiences that I go through with jazz and improvising and chord record, like anything that requires any skill whatsoever. I always fall back on those intervals and just being able to recognize them, like having them scarred, because I don't have perfect pitch. I don't have anything close to being able to, you know,
recognize. Do you have any of that tombal pitch thing? So the kind of connection to the... So, like, if you hear someone playing something on a saxophone, do you just...
Oh, totally. I could tell you for sure every note that so long as it's on the saxophone, you can, like the tone, the way the key work is designed, kind of depends. I think maybe it depends how good the player is. Someone like Chris Potter, who's so utterly, like, at one with the instrument, who has overcome every possible problem, it's a little harder with him because he sounds so incredible on every note, but most other saxophone players, no disrespect to someone like Joshua Redman, but Chris Potter's in a stratosphere of his own when it comes to controlling the beast.
The instrument.
Yeah. So with most people, you can tell straight away what note they're playing. Anyway.
Can you ever do that? Can you ever imagine when you're hearing, say, like a piano player play or a trumpet player or whatever, can you just imagine where that would be on your horn and then know where it is?
No.
No, okay.
Never even come across my mind.
The interesting thing about a lot of this for me is that a lot of people use different language to describe the same things. So in the absolute pitch literature, what you've just described is seen as like a kind of lower form of absolute pitch. But most people who do that, who are musicians, would call it relative pitch.
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Whereas in the scientific literature, relative pitch is kind of more specifically defined as, well, there are kind of two types. This guy called Karpinski's broken them apart. So there's one which is kind of interval identification. And the other one is functional relative pitch, so recognizing everything in relation to the key center that you're in at any given time and sort of hearing all of those different tensions as emotions and being able to pick those up quite fast in that way. So that's what's generally seen as relative pitch in the literature, whereas absolute pitch can be broken into all sorts of different skills. It's not a single skill either. But one of the lower forms in the scientific literature is kind of what you just described there. So you'd call that tombal absolute pitch.
Right. Wow.
Which I think is interesting enough. But a lot of the time you hear someone say, I have relative pitch. And you don't know what they mean exactly. Because for one person, that means they can identify a few intervals. And for another person, that means that you play them anything on their instrument and they can hear it absolutely fine. For someone else, it means, you know, you play anything on any instrument, and just by imagining it on your own instrument, you hear everything absolutely fine, perhaps limited to the range of the instrument that you play.
Yeah.
So all of these different things, I don't think we talk about it enough. It's oral training is an area that could really be opened up a lot more, I think.
Yeah, it's an interesting, like, I know Gwilym Simcock has perfect pitch, like, which is the ability to play to hear a note and know what note it is, you know. So if I walk over to my piano and like close his eyes, pick a note and play it, he will tell me what the note is.
Oh, I thought you were going to play me one, sorry.
Oh, I can. That's brilliant.
That's right. Do you know what,
Sam? I've got my saxophone right next to me. Let's try and experiment.
Am I getting tested now? Oh, no.
Well, let's just see. Let's see, actually. Yeah, okay. So this transposition, you would think at my age wouldn't be a problem. But I'm just going to... So this saxophone is not in the key of C. Okay, here we go.
That's a D.
Yes!
Yeah.
How do you know?
I've developed a method which for this PhD, which teaches people absolute pitch qualities. So to that extent, I think it's learnable. The problem I'm having is making it musically useful.
That's amazing.
It's much easier for me to hear you do that and tell you what note it is or to sing you a note than it is for me to hear it in the context of a bunch of music. I think my relative pitch then kicks in and it's harder to kind of hear things in that way, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like a massive advantage to have like inborn perfect pitch and then try and learn jazz because it's really complicated.
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah. I don't know whether it's an advantage.
It wasn't really a question, was it?
I've got, I don't know, like most of my favorite, like the reason I'm interested in it isn't because I think it's, you know, the musical holy grail as such. Like a lot of my favorite musicians are people that haven't had it. And some of them people who I don't think thought their ears were that great, like, to my knowledge, I don't think Coltrane thought his ears were amazing, but he just sort of worked really hard. I'm pretty sure it's the same with Dewey Redman, who's one of my absolute favourites.
Yeah.
Although obviously it goes both ways. Like people like Keith Jarrett definitely do have it, and pretty astounding as well. It's definitely something which would be a useful skill to have, but I don't think it's, you know, there are plenty of amazing musicians who don't have it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, going back. Mm-hmm. To my original question about starting the piano then. At what point in life did you realise that you wanted to actually do this for a living?
I got the bug quite late, actually. So I was doing like classical piano lessons and things throughout my school years, and I always liked music, but I was always very bad at practicing the stuff I was supposed to practice. I'd go to the piano and just sort of play pop tunes I liked or try and write something, you know. And so lesson in, lesson out, I was always a pretty useless student. I sort of never really did the work. And then when I became a teenager, I wanted to really kind of rock out, and I played guitar as well. So I switched across to that in terms of how I saw myself for a bit, and just sort of became a shredder. And I actually used to sing in rock bands in those days as well, which is
nice.
Yeah, you don't want to ever hear that.
There's one amongst the tracks you sent.
No, you're not going to find them in there, luckily. But yeah, so that's where I came from. But actually, I think that education opened me up to the jazz thing more, because obviously it's less sort of sitting in a room with a page of music in front of you and trying to play it perfectly. It's more just like just going and having fun playing music that you've written with a bunch of your mates, and that's nice. And I think that kind of drew me more into the jazz thing. I had quite an inspiring teacher. What would I say? I think he'd see himself as more of a teacher than a player. It's probably the best way to put it, but when I was a kid, I wonder whether this would be frowned upon now. There's such a kind of weird, people are so scared about kind of adult and child friendships because of all of the, you know,
yes,
reasons we can imagine. But when I was early to mid-teens, he was taking me out to pubs to go and watch jazz gigs. So I'd go and watch Gareth LeCrane playing at the Horseshoe in Clerkenwell because he'd say, it's a great gig, let's go to that.
Hmm.
And it was a really, really nice thing to have happen. And I know he's done that with students since then, and he's like not remotely dodgy, and it's a really great thing for a teacher to do. But then in retrospect, I'd be terrified of doing that, like with a student in school. I'm not sure I'd ever offer to take a student to the pub one-on-one to a gig. That sounds like a terrible idea. It's sort of firing 101, isn't it? But it was a really nice thing that happened there, and I got to see some pretty amazing UK musicians. Who else did I see? People like Alciona Mick and Mike Outram, all whilst I was, you know, at school.
That's a beautiful play. So how far was that pub from where you were living?
Pretty far. I was brought up in Ealing originally, and then Twickenham.
Twickenham, cool. Sorry,
why did you say that? You're a rugby fan, though.
No, well, all my work is in Twickenham. I only live like 10 minutes away. So,
oh, I see. Where do you work?
Privately, because I used to live there, so all my students are based there, and there's just so many families that when I moved to Sunbury, I kind of thought all the work would slowly move here. It just hasn't.
Okay.
Basically, yeah.
So you're still trekking all the way in.
I love it though. I really like Twickenham.
That's nice around there. Where did you live when you were there?
On Second Cross Road, which is,
Do you vaguely remember that? Is that going out towards Strawberry Hill?
Yeah, exactly. So, like, you go through Twickenham and then past Twickenham Green, and then the roads, it's like an American style, first, second, third, cross. Yeah. You know, they just numbered them rather than gave the names.
So I think I used to go for German tuition on Fifth Cross
Road. Yeah, that's Waldegrave School is on that road.
Actually, it was Waldegrave School where I had the jazz lessons with this teacher as well. Obviously, that's a girls' school, but cool. I went there on Saturday mornings. And I ended up teaching there afterwards. He kind of got me involved as a teacher once I'd, grown too old for it.
Yeah.
I know Waldegrave School pretty well.
Oh, that's amazing. Fancy that.
It also makes me think I probably got the street name wrong, because I definitely didn't have German lessons on the same street as Waldegrave.
Okay.
But anyway, there you go.
Cool. Now you see my outrageous excitement for Twickenham. and just while I'm on the subject, where do you live now?
I live in Charlton, which is near Greenwich.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, I love it around here.
Yeah.
I moved here for the worst possible reasons, but it's worked out really well.
Oh,
so finished Academy, I don't know. Maybe it's the time I was there, but all of the best parties seemed to be the Trinity parties.
Yeah.
And so I'd find myself in Greenwich so much, I just thought, sod it, let's live here.
Oh, that's brilliant.
But obviously the parties have dried up. Luckily Greenwich is nice and I've wanted to stay here after, you know.
Now, how long have you been there for now?
Oh, God. Maybe since 2009 or something.
Wow, that's great.
A long, long time. Not in the house I'm in now. But in the Greenwich area.
Yeah. Would you ever move or leave, or is this the place for you?
In theory, I don't know, like if I ever got bold enough to want to do a New York pilgrimage, then maybe I'd try that. Although it'd be difficult. I'm relatively tied down to the place I live in because I kind of own the house I have. I managed to get it off the back of a mixture of things, including a bit of inheritance when my grandparents died. It makes it more difficult to move.
Yes. Yes, it does. Mm. Especially now, not to get into it, but, you know, it's not a great time to sell a house.
No, it's a really terrible time to do it. The house prices are dropping in this area, and I haven't had it that long. It wasn't that long ago that my grandparents died. So it would be a relatively daft move.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. We bought our flat at the peak of the property prices like 2 and 3 years ago.
And then it's all gone wrong since then.
Yes, it has. let's move swiftly on. So when did you decide, like, let's talk about college. Like, where did you apply to? Did you do all your auditions when you were like 17, 18?
No, not at all, actually. I hadn't really ever heard of the Royal Academy of Music. Or I think I'd heard of the Royal College, but it was so off my radar at that point. You know, I think when I was doing my A-levels, I thought I might want to go and do chemistry. And then I think in my AS chemistry, I got an E, and decided maybe that wasn't the subject for me after all. Gave that one up instantly. I think behind the scenes, I always knew I wanted to do music. That's the thing that I've always been thinking about for all of my life. But there's that thing of what you want to do and then what you think you should do, and also what other people think you should do.
Yeah.
You're always balancing those off. But I think eventually I just thought, you know, so I want to do music. But I initially went and did the university thing. So I went to King's College London.
Right.
Did the academic training. So I learned how to write fugues and bits and bobs, which was fun. But one of the nice things about that is I think this happens across the whole of the University of London. There's an ability to take courses in other institutions within the University of London.
Right.
And I quickly found that King's College London wasn't completely the place for me. I got my piano lessons arranged through Academy. So I instantly went into having lessons with Simon Purcell at that time.
Right.
And I went to the composition classes with Pete Churchill, which are actually one of the best things about the Academy course. And I was doing that as someone that, to be honest, didn't really know that much about jazz at that time. I thought I did.
So this was all through University of London? You could just like rock up and check it out?
It wasn't so much rocking up and checking out. I could actually take those as modules.
Oh.
And I think I weighed up learning about the life of Mozart or whatever with going and playing jazz. And I thought, that sounds much better. Yeah. I could do that. A couple of us, myself and this guy called Tim Evans, paved the way at King's for jazz students. So we both did this advanced performance unit as jazz musicians for the first time. Until that point, it had been like a classical only course, and we just sort of put our feet down and said we wanted to do it, and we were allowed on.
Oh, brilliant.
Which was great.
Yeah.
The connection's really good, actually. And I know a few people that have done it since me as well. I also went and learnt like batar drums at SOAS, which was fun.
Nice. That sounds really interesting.
Pick all these different routes. But I tried to, because I loved Academy so much, I tried to switch across in my second year. And I auditioned then. And I was really excited about it, and then I didn't get in, so that was a shame. And then at the end of the course, I thought, well, I still want to go. So I applied as a postgrad and got in then, which was really good, actually. I was in the same year as George Crowley and Tom Leeper and all those guys.
Wow, so you actually left right before I started. I had never realised that.
I think that's true.
Essentially, I think of myself as George's replacement, because he was the last saxophone player before me, you know, on that course.
Okay. So you were a postgrad as well, is that?
Yeah, that's right, in 2010.
So what did you do before that? What was?
I did classical saxophone at the Northern, at the Royal Northern.
Okay, nice.
Yeah, it's all like contemporary. I didn't really do any classical saxophone. Like, I was supposed to, but I just played jazz and quite enjoyed it.
Sounds like my university experience.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't really do the course I was on at all. And then really wanted to go to Academy. And it was fun.
To be honest, those first few years of King's were amazing on that front. Like, I did almost none of the work I was supposed to do for King's. Somehow I scraped a first out at the end. I don't know exactly how I did that.
Nice.
For the whole time I was there, I just totally obsessed about jazz in a way I hadn't before. And just, it was, you know, kind of like the stories you hear about Coltrane practicing all day. I was doing that. I'd worked out this tight schedule in sort of set amount of minutes for different things I needed to work on, and I was just doing that. And then when the alarm bell went, I move on to the next thing. When the alarm bell went into the next thing.
Yeah.
Do that for several hours each day, and it was really exciting. I think that's probably the only period of my playing music where I've really felt myself getting better at a rate. I guess it's easier when you're worse. I guess it's easier at the beginning, isn't it? But still, it was a really inspiring period, just learning all those different things, and doing none of the work that I was actually supposed to be doing.
Excellent. Yeah, it's like It's like in Formula One. I talk about this far too much. The law of marginal gains, they call it, you know. The faster your car is, the harder it is to improve it. For the guys at the back, it's quite easy to find. But that's what it is, you know, in our position, when you like wanting to do any practice or learn something new, I'm always like, oh my God, this is going to take months.
Mm-hmm. And it usually does. And I think to learn anything properly, it takes a long time. And you don't never get that complete payoff. You sort of wish that one day a big tick came up and it was like, you've smashed that, great, next one.
Yeah.
But you just kind of, you know, you worry about it. You think you're rubbish at it. You keep practicing it. Then some other things come into your mind and you're practicing those. And eventually somewhere down the line, you realize you can do that thing that you were working on before. But you never really get the joy of realizing you've done it. It's just kind of, you know, passively enters your playing.
yeah. So what then, between academy, when did you start the PhD?
I think it was 2012 or 13. I've been doing it for a long time. I'm doing it part time, in my defense. I haven't just so it's supposed to be 5 years. We could probably do the maths and work that out backwards. So
5 years full time or 5 years part time?
5 years part time.
Okay.
So I'm now over. So I guess that means I started in 2013.
Right.
And then. Or was it maybe even 2014? That would make sense.
Okay.
I can't remember. I'm over now by a little bit. I still have this kind of leeway period in which to finish it, but I've, yeah.
But you're nearly there.
Too long. Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty amazing process doing a PhD. Well, it's a pretty amazing process. I think one of the reasons I've enjoyed it is that I did it in something that I'd never done before, which involves needing to know even more about even more things that I'd never even thought about before.
Yeah.
And so I think I'd reached a point where I was playing music all the time and doing the musician thing and loving that, but feeling like there were parts of my brain not being used that I wanted to kick back into action again.
Right.
Since then I've had to learn statistics, programming, psychology from scratch, you know, this sort of massive list of things, psychophysics. I don't claim to be particularly good at it, but even just the learning how to program thing has been geekily exciting. It's nice. Yeah. There's something similar to the feeling you get when you're practicing and you've created something and you feel good about it, that you get when you're working on a problem in code and there's something not working and it takes you a while and you have to sort of look through it and sort out the logic in your heads, and eventually you suss out what it is and you fix it, and suddenly this code you've written does something that you really wanted it to do. It's very rewarding.
Yeah.
Although I had a day recently where I did have a bit of an existential crisis when I realized I was coding wearing a Star Wars t-shirt.
What have I become?
It was one of those. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
On the same day, I walked down the street to the shop around the corner from where I live, and this guy sort of started looking at me weird, and I was like, oh God, what's going to happen? Is he going to come over and just say something awful? This sort of geeky looking bloke. And he came over to me and just said, nice t-shirt, mate, and walked off. So I had the Star Wars moment and then was complicated and then complimented by a definite geek.
Wow.
I don't know, it's fine. Geek and proud, it's all right.
Yes. So how will having a PhD, is it like something where you can look for like different jobs that you couldn't do before? Like, do you have any idea what in your life will change when you finish it?
There was a hint of wanting to get more university type jobs in my mind when I started it, but I was also really interested in the topic, and I think that was the main reason for doing it.
Okay.
Since then, I actually am lecturing in a uni. I teach at Middlesex part time.
Oh, cool.
Which is fun. Not psychology. I teach jazz and pop music. I'm on the I'm in the pop department, teaching performance and musicianship mainly, amongst other things.
That sounds fun. Is that something that you... is it fun?
It's loads of fun. Yeah, I really love teaching. And I guess a lot of my PhD is about how to teach a skill as well. And I really enjoy teaching little kids piano. I still do that on one day.
Yeah.
I think I wouldn't enjoy it quite so much if it was more than one day, and I don't claim to enjoy it the whole year round. But overall, I think it's really interesting. Just it's kind of like an interesting little puzzle, sort of watching someone learn, because everyone's so different, and you're trying to suss out the best way of communicating this idea to them, and it's and you're trying to work out how much they understand, and it's I'm not really selling it, but it's for me that's really exciting. And then I have the same thing with teaching classes. So with I like teaching kind of difficult classes, I guess, and not difficult in behavior wise, but difficult like quite mixed ability, because it's such a challenge having to deliver material in a way that keeps everyone on board, and to set tasks where the people who are really finding it very easy feel challenged, and the people who are finding it really difficult get enough of your time to get better, and all of those things. And off the back of doing this job, I ended up having to do PG Cert, which is I've got a certificate in higher education teaching, basically. And that was really fascinating, learning about sort of various learning theories and a lot of, so I don't know if you come across a lot of the sort of standard teacher training stuff, like sort of Vygotsky and the idea of scaffolding and all that business before.
No, I've not. Nothing like that.
It's all very intuitive and obvious, but sometimes it's nice to have these things crystallized for you. So Vygotsky's thing is called the zone of proximal development, which is a very fancy sounding term for essentially thinking of teaching as something that works towards different works at different development stages towards goals.
Yeah.
And then the idea of scaffolding wasn't from Vygotsky, but is kind of usually tied in with that idea, which is really straightforward. It's just the idea that you provide lots of support towards that goal at the beginning when the development is happening.
Yeah.
And then as the student gets better at it, you sort of pull it away bit by bit until they're doing it off their own volition, and you move on to the next stage.
Oh,
trying
beautiful.
To see learning in these stages.
Yeah.
Which I think we all do, right? I think we all think in those ways when we teach anyway. But it's
I obsess over like independence, you know, they're like you say, every week, like giving a bit less and hoping they think a bit more until one day they don't need you anymore.
Exactly. That's the goal of a good teacher, is to try and make yourself redundant.
Yeah, that is though. That's really the biggest part of my thinking pretty much all the time.
It ties in a lot with the motivation literature as well. So obviously the best kind of motivation that anyone can have is the one that presumably we both have towards jazz now, which is just grasping the inherent value of the task and really caring about it and wanting to do it for ourselves. And you sort of, in that frame of mind, you teach yourself things and you go and seek out the information that you need. And that's really great. But when you're delivering stuff to a class, they most of the time won't have that kind of intrinsic motivation, and you need to try and deliver things in a way that or rather delivery is almost the problem. You're trying to teach things in a way that gets them to grasp that so that they can teach themselves, more than just standing in front of a class and giving them loads of information that they don't in some fundamental way care about, and therefore will never actually learn. Or even if they learn it in some small scale past the exam kind of way, it will never influence their lives in any important way. It's kind of trying to do your best to get them to grasp the importance and meaning of any task, and why that would be something that would be good for their lives, you know.
Yeah, the why is so important, I think, if you're trying to motivate a group to do anything.
Absolutely. What's your relationship with teaching? So how much do you do?
Loads. I absolutely love it. So I'm doing 5 days a week. loads and loads of primary.
That's loads of teaching, yeah.
Yeah, mostly like three schools, lots of private students, and then like I've got a small group of adults that learn each week, which is really nice. And the, you know, the ones that really like that I particularly like highly commended, you know, are like teenagers who just want to do it because they want to learn. That really always blows my mind that like they could choose to just do their homework and watch TV, but they are like, they're asking like, give me some work to do. What can I learn to like empower myself and learn? You know,
I just
I've got all the time in the world for that. Like, you know,
is that within a school or from a music service? Or these are private, aren't they?
These are all private students. Yeah. So like my schools are all primary schools. But you know, it's a lot of fun. But then, yeah, the teenagers are all through like word of mouth. Most of them know each other, you know, where I've had one and then one said to their friend that it was cool or whatever. And it slowly, all in Twickenham, you know, it slowly spreads.
So you're going to be one of these jazz teachers, aren't you? The Twickenham area is going to suddenly be bursting with amazing young jazz students because you're there and inspiring them.
Well, allegedly. Yes. I got Sam Rapley lives just up the road from me as well. So he's kind of doing the Richmond area in a similar way. And actually, pianist John Cervantes, I don't know if you
know John. Yeah,
John lives in Twickenham as well. So he won't do beginners so much. So I think what will happen, genuinely what will happen, is that John will start picking up my kids as they get too good for me, basically. Yeah. And then John will refine them. And,
from that point.
But no, it's great. That's one of the things about having so many people coming out of music college and not that many higher education roles is that, that like there's loads of people in Southwest London kicking around doing, you know, Tom Walsh as well, the spectacular trumpet player.
Yeah, amazing.
Lived in Richmond for years.
I had no idea where these guys lived in Richmond. Should have hit some people up when I went back for Christmas. I did bump into Quentin Collins on Christmas Eve.
Oh, cool. Where?
Because he used to, he's from around the neck of the woods as well. Oh, just in a pub, the old ship in Richmond.
Oh, that's amazing.
And Andrew McCormack was there as well. Like, just randomly, I was there meeting another friend.
That's so
they
weird.
All walked in. I was like,
that's
what are you doing
good.
Here?
That's so good. I love when that happens.
It's nice to know there's some people around.
Yeah. But no, it's really interesting talking to you about it because, like you say, my relationship with myself with teaching is as you say, it's really like self-critical and analytical, where I just try something and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, and you come away and ask yourself why and what you could do better, and then you go back in. And I've just been doing that for like 6 years now, trying to get
and you just get better
smarter.
And better at it, don't you? Yeah
that you hopefully your judgment improves.
It does hurt when you screw up, though, doesn't it? I've pulled
people out of exams before because I put them in and they weren't ready and it was completely my fault, you know, and then you dent the kids' confidence as well and the parent, you know, yeah, it hurts, but there's only one way to learn and you just feel bad
just
for
doing
those,
it, yeah.
Those first fat couple of families, you know, the ones that I had a couple when I was at Academy who were having a weekly lesson when I just didn't know anything.
Yeah.
You know, plenty about
the
jazz.
Same thing when I taught at Aylesbury Music Service when I was at Academy. And yeah, in retrospect, I'm concerned about what I was doing. one of the students I taught has sort of since grown up and gone to Trinity and is a composer and does all these things.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
She informs me it wasn't too bad. So hopefully.
That's good. That's good. There's a one survivor.
Exactly, yeah. Oh, God.
Oh, man. So, look, before we finish, Sam, let's quickly talk about how you've done quite a few albums, quite a lot of recording, as well as everything else that we've talked about.
Yeah.
How many of those are like a solo thing or like you as the band leader?
Zero of those are a solo thing.
Okay.
Although I'd love to do that. That'd be a really nice thing to do. It's sort of terrifying at the same time. But, yeah, one of these days, maybe, hopefully.
Okay.
So the albums
what,
are
yeah, oh, yeah sorry that's it that's my question what are the albums
I've preempted it I've got this album with Dan Tetfer that we talked about earlier. That's a piano duet.
Yeah.
Recorded that in New York in 2016.
Oh, cool.
And I wrote and performed it with him 2 years earlier at the Steinway Festival, Pizza Express. So yeah, really proud of that. That came out most recently.
Yeah.
To be honest, there was another record I put out last year, or I put out in duet with someone else that I'm really proud of, that I was kind of sad didn't really kick off so much press-wise. But that's with... Have you come across Paula Rae Gibson before?
No.
So she's...
Is this the track Permission from that album that we're going to play in a couple of minutes? Okay.
Oh, we're doing it. Oh, great. Okay. Yeah, well, I'm really, really... happy with the album, and that was, I think it's kind of testament to her and the way she works that it came out so well, and that I've ended up feeling so happy about it. But essentially, she's one of these people that kind of is just as general artist rather than necessarily a musician or a photographer or any of the many things she does. Filmmaker, she sort of tries her hand at everything and has an interesting angle on all of those things. Like, always produces something pretty happening. So I'm not convinced, if I had a musical chat with her about kind of music theory or anything like that, that she'd know what I was talking about. Yet when we did a recording like this, she can respond in the most musical of ways, in this kind of very happening intuitive sense.
Yeah.
And she writes these amazing lyrics. So the album was a completely improvised album from beginning to end. In typical haphazard Paula fashion, I hadn't realised we were even recording an album when I showed up for it. So I thought we were going for a rehearsal in Luton just to sort of try some things out. And I got there, it was like, oh no, we're in a studio. Fair enough.
That's brilliant.
And we just downed a couple of glasses of wine and then went in.
Great.
And,
rehearsal over.
The rehearsal over, exactly. What more do you need? But she'd written all these sort of pockets of lyrics, because the whole thing's improvised. It wasn't like, you know, here's a lyric for this song. But she had all these lines that she wanted, and she had them all, kind of all out around her as reminders. She actually also had a dog in the studio, so it was properly eccentric. It was
great.
You can hear the dog on some of the recordings.
That makes me feel good, because I won't get into this, but the film I've just made...
I'd love it if you did get into that, actually. The Richard Turner one, right?
Yeah, that's right. Andrew, Richard's brother, kept his dog with him during his interview. And there's two scenes. There's one where you can just full on hear him, like, trying to stifle himself from barking. And another where he just starts, like, licking and washing himself. But, of course, the microphone I use picks it up in incredible detail. So they're like,
it's all on there.
Oh yeah, there's no getting away from it either.
That's brilliant.
There's no software to remove dogs from the audio, as you know.
Not yet. You know, I'm sure they'll. You know, it's 2019. That's going to happen soon. It's amazing you made that film, though. That's absolutely incredible. I mean, like a lot of us, I had all the time in the world for Rich. I'd recently formed a quintet with him the year that he died. We were having all these rehearsals on a pretty regular basis round at his place.
Yeah.
With sort of Mike Chillingworth and Mark Lewandowski and all those guys at the time as well. And we were having all these interesting chats, and I was really getting on with him, but then he just suddenly was dead, and it was this really sort of tragic blow, like it was for a lot of people when it happened.
Yeah.
And he was this... amazing character who did so much for the scene. Like, I used to go to the Consola bar pretty much every week back when I was at college.
Yeah.
Such a important guy for the scene. So I was really happy to see that you've made that film.
Yeah, well, the idea is to, as you and I well know how important he was, to see if I could transfer that message and make it accessible to a whole new audience of people. Who could like see our scene and see how it's different as a result. So I gave it my best shot, but it's coming, it's premiering in April.
I can't wait to see it. Yeah. Where's it premiering?
It's being shown at Royal Academy, and it's being shown at Leeds College of Music, and I've just submitted it to three film festivals, and actually at about 1 o'clock this morning, someone at Leeds Jazz Festival sent me an email asking if they, please, could we show your film at the Jazz Festival? To which I, of course, like, got out of bed to fall to my knees.
Yeah.
Because it's like any time anything like that happens that I haven't had to push and instigate loads, it's just the most incredible thing.
It's a beautiful feeling, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, no one's seen it yet, so I appreciate that they're just going to take a punt. Because, I mean, I think it's great, but I'm biased, so...
Yeah. I'm sure it is great, but yeah. You are also biased, I'll give you that. But yeah, anyway, so nice one for making it, and I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting, like, you know, talking about the PhD and the time you've spent on it, you know, the film feels weirdly similar. Like, I feel like I have a master's equivalent level of knowledge in Richard Turner's music, life and playing now. Because it's taken like 2 years to make
researching to that level.
Yeah, and I didn't know him very well, so yeah, like you say, there's an awful lot of research to start before you can even know what are the right questions to ask.
To ask in the first place. What was it that made you want to make it?
It was the podcast, actually. It was about the time Dan and I started this, and like immediately I thought, you know, that Rich would have been a really funny character to interview. And then I thought
for definite
I was like, well, it's such a shame that maybe we could make a tribute to him podcast, like, just because he's not here doesn't mean he should be left out of this selection process, you know, that what if I made a podcast and we could just interview people and listen to what they're and then I thought, well, you can't really see who's talking, which is actually a major issue in my opinion, if you're going to try and make something like that and have it have any emotional impact. So then, of course, it was like, oh, well, if I videoed the interviews, I could do it, you know. And then it was like, well, if I'm going to video them, I could make it like a whole feature length documentary. And, you know, and so it kind of just it didn't feel like my idea. Like, as soon as the seed was sown of like, Rich could have been on the podcast, the rest of it just sort of fell into place instantly. And then once I'd had the idea, I couldn't not do it. It would have eaten away inside at me every day of like, why aren't I making this film? What am I like? Every time I was like relaxing, I know, you know, it was like I had to, whether I wanted to or not, frankly. Otherwise I'd have just asked myself for all time, like what could that film have been like if I'd have had the
that makes it sound even more special. Yeah, it's exciting stuff.
Well, it's a labor of love, which hopefully you know, like, making a film is quite hard actually, and it takes quite a long time, so
I believe it. Yeah. Although you say it's a labor of love, I feel like pretty much everything that every jazz musician does is a labor of
love. Exactly, it wasn't a culture shock. Oh, I'm going to do loads of work for no money. That's fine. Yeah, that's what I was already doing.
Never done that before, exactly. What are we doing with our lives?
Well, Sam, thank you so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast. It's been an enormous pleasure to try and look inside of your brain.
See what's been a pleasure to be on it. Thanks so much for having me.
Awesome. So this last track, Permission, remind me the singer's name again?
Paula Rae Gibson.
Paula Rae Gibson. All right, here it goes.
Let's play love. Let's play. You're my everything. Let me edit your every word. Disappearance into limerence. Let's play love. Let's play your moment. Let's let our curiosity lead the way. No judgment the next day. Let's just be animals, no clothes on. For a change, let's just dig into all the haze and allow ourselves, give ourselves permission. Let's play now. No one...
So, Dan, next week is going to be Tom Walsh, I hope.
Is that right? Tom Walsh.
Yeah, let's see if Tom has a Wikipedia page, shall we? See if he can compete with Sam Lee.
Tom Walsh, isn't it? The Grandfather's guy, Tommy Walsh.
Oh, I've got Tom Walsh footballer. Ground Force.
No, am I totally off?
I don't know. I've found some stuff about Tom Walsh. He plays on the Spice Fusion album, which is one that we previewed a couple of months ago. Tom is a prolific and powerful guy who's, he seems to be doing, you know, everything. He's like, you know, every time I go on his like Facebook page, he's in LA or Singapore traveling and playing the trumpet.
Makes sense.
Living the big time life, a life which we will never know.
Yeah.
So I threatened last week that Mary James was going to come on the show, but she's going backwards a bit to February.
Is that right?
For admin reasons.
Same as Nikki Isles.
Exactly. It's becoming a trend of people agreeing to come on the show, listening to the show, and then...
And then changing their minds.
Yes. So hopefully no future guests will listen, and then we can carry on for a long time. This is my message.
Fingers crossed.
So I'll see you. We're going to do another one next Friday, hopefully.
Okay.
Yeah. Continue the 2019 barrage. Oh, if you're still here and you're still listening, if you could be so kind as to go on to, you know, the Apple Podcasts, give us 5 stars, or come find our Facebook page and like us. If you feel like you want to do that, then
oh, we've got a Facebook page now, haven't we?
Yeah, we have like a Facebook business. We're open all hours, so...
Is that right?
Oh, Dan, the coffee! Yeah. We have to...
Oh, yeah, we got sent some coffee.
That was one of the greatest moments of my entire professional broadcasting career. Absolutely remarkable. Big time, big time shout out to Lee Wagstaff for hooking us up.
What was his name?
Lee Wagstaff.
What a great name.
Yep, I don't know, he's... There's a great little provider up in the Peak District, bag of Peak Beans Finest Blend, that Lee sent us both.
What was the story around it? How did it come to be?
It came to be because we talked about our love of coffee on Loz Garrett's show, which is almost 2 years old. And Lee said he listened to it and he heard that we both like coffee and he thought we'd just quite like a bag each.
Oh, that's so sweet.
It's incredible.
Thanks, Lee.
Yeah, we're incredibly grateful. And also...
If anyone else wants to listen to this thing.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like...
Feel free.
Like, come on, listeners. It's time.
We're doing this. You haven't been paid anything.
So for 2 years of work so far, we've earned one bag of coffee each.
How many grams? 50.
Oh, I'm excited. All right. All right.
Okay.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Dan.
Always a waste.
I will see you next Friday.
See you next week.